How's the event so far? Good? Amazing. Thank you again for coming here. It's a great pleasure to be here with you and reviewing some of you that I haven't seen for a while. I've been here in 2012, I think. So it's a revisit. So today we're going to talk about architecture best practices. How many of you are architects? Cool. So we have all cool stuff. How many of you are interested in architecture and think architecture is even fun? Okay, good. Then you're in the right place. So my name is Nuno Godinho. I'm an Azure MVP since the beginning. I'm also right now a general manager of software engineering for GE Healthcare, covering all of Europe. With a lot of different hats, but let's stay with this one. So one of my passions is the cloud, and another one is architecture. So, and joining the two is just getting lucky. One important disclaimer: when you work in big corporations, you need to do this kind of things. This represents only my opinions, okay? Let's not forget that. How many of you know what this is? I work in healthcare, so I decided to try to show you a little bit of what the heck do I do every day. I heard lungs and embryo. Who thinks they are lungs? Who votes for embryo? Who votes for? I have no clue what the hell that is. That was my first. When I looked the first time of this, it's like, yeah, it's a rolling something. It's actually embryos. Who said embryos? 5 points. We need to get something to him. It's really good. This is actually embryos. This is some of the things we do in the software engineering, is with that image, show you something like this. So there is a lot about imaging analytics. There is a lot about image processing. But this is software. This is software engineering. Actually, when I joined GE Healthcare, I told my wife, finally, I'm working for the good guys. I'm actually going to help someone eventually. And then I thought, oh, we sometimes do bugs. It's like, oh, crap. We might need to get some to be careful. But it's great. This type of thing, the ability to see this, the ability to take an image from one of the echoes and actually generating based on those 2D images, generate these kinds of videos. It's pretty cool. It's pretty impactful. So this is now my day-to-day work. Another part, if this actually would start, would be lovely. This is another part. Oh, apparently, PowerPoint was crashing. This is basically another part of my work, is another set of projects. It's actually happened here in Sweden, in Uppsala. We're pretty close. So this is a cell mitosis, so the cell separation. One of the critical things in order to understand how cancer spreads, how to understand immediately if there is a cancer cell or not, is through this. So the dots you see, who knows what those dots are? I have to learn a lot about healthcare now. Any votes? What those are? Those are DNA. So those are the DNA markers. So based on those DNA markers and how the separation appears, we actually can analyze these different videos. And based on this, we're actually analyzing, trying to understand if there is a potential for that cell to be cancer, even before it starts. So just by the fact that it is splitting in a different way. Anybody heard? Probably Michelle knows this story about Emily Whitehead. Anybody heard? A US kid that had cancer? So actually, we put some of this crazy stuff on imaging, and we helped trying to get to a new treatment for trying to cure cancer. It actually worked, at least for Emily. So this is the type of thing. So software engineering and architecture is not only to do cool stuff. Actually, sometimes it actually saves lives. That's what we do. Now, let's go to our topic. I just wanted to give you a little bit of brief. How many of you actually knew what people do in software in healthcare companies, apart from doing revenue management systems, which are important, actually very important. But this part is a lot cooler. Okay, so on our topic, architecture best practices. One of the parts, and we're going to touch several parts, one is the design concept of a cloud solution. Understand what are the critical design considerations we should do, and look at some real-life stories, which I've done, and some of the lessons I learned. Great lessons that Michelle was showing, and one of the things is we learn some new things every day. And as Michelle said, two days ago, probably the recommendation would be different. So we need to keep always understanding what's coming up. So to start, design concept for cloud solutions. Let's understand. So designing applications for the cloud. A lot of people start to say designing applications for the cloud is completely different. How many of you have heard that? Is it or not? It's not actually different if you already were doing multi-tenant applications that run on a distributed system inside an abstraction within commodity hardware at an internet scale composed with multiple services. Then it's actually the same thing. So yeah, it's the same thing. The cloud is actually around this element. So multi-tenancy. We need to think that the resources that we are, the platform where we're running in Azure, we're not alone. We're not alone in the world. And yes, that's why we have throttling mechanisms. So our design, when we design, we need to think that we're not alone. And we shouldn't try to behave as if we were. What this means is we need to design things to use the resources we have, being that memory, being that CPU, being that storage, in a way that we actually know exactly what is it for. So for example, one of the times I went in and I asked, okay, so what's the architecture, what's your deployment topology, what's the sizes of the machines, and there was someone with a G1. And I said, oh, okay, cool. Why? It's like, I don't understand the question. It's like, okay, why do you have a G1? Oh, why not? Like, okay, I would like to have your bank account, but suddenly that is very interesting. Also, the fact, one of the things that a lot of people were moving to SQL in a VM was because actually SQL Azure was imposing some multi-tenancy limitations. We need to behave in that environment. The other part is a distributed system. So a distributed systems is basically will have load balancing. So we need to think that is there is redundancy. It's not only one instance, it's multiple instances. So we need to have that in consideration. If one fails, what does happen to the next one? So if we already did this, then we're safe. The other part is an abstraction. We're working on abstractions. So how many of you know containers? Have been wandering around and playing around with containers. Containers are a way to provide abstractions. Basically, containerize something, abstracting from the underlying OS, where is going. So it's basically, we need to understand that we are basically interacting with APIs. We're basically in a PaaS world. We don't control the hardware, and we need to be okay with that. Commodity hardware at internet scale. So now we have the, of course, there is things that change in Azure. So 3 years ago, what was the biggest machine we had in Azure? 8 cores. What's the biggest machine we have today in Azure? Any ideas? Memory, for example. We have, I think, 14 gigs was the max some years ago. Now we have one with 500 and something. 512. It's important, but there's still a lot of commodity and internet scale kind of hardware. So one of the strategies, one of the best practices is you need to understand, you need to try to place things into very small elements. It's much better to have a lot of small elements, small instances that work together that actually have a big beast that does something. Sometimes you actually need to do it. So if you're working, for example, on imaging, you actually would need, actually, we would love to have a GPU one, but that's a different story. So it's important to design, understand the restrictions of the resources that we have. Because if you don't, then something will happen and it's not good. Then we have composed by multiple services. So Michelle presented just before, presented something around the several services that are. So it's about composing, it's composed applications. It's about segregation. It's about taking a lot of different sets of services and actually join them together. If we want to have real cloud solutions, real cloud architectures, we need to embrace segregation. We need to embrace the fact that a lot of small pieces that are independent, responsible for one part of the overall process, that will provide us reliability, that will provide us fault tolerance, that will provide us a healthy solution, and eventually would actually save us money, which sometimes is important. So, any questions so far? Comments? Personal attacks or other? No? Okay. Okay, not yet. Good. So, what are the critical design considerations? It's services at scale, so failure is expected. Failures don't only happen, they are expected. When we're building an application, when we're building an architecture, if we assume in that architecture that the solution won't fail, I hate to break it to you, it will. Your application will die, you'll lose some information. Now, if you're working on some critical solutions, that might be a serious problem. In some cases, it might not, and use compensating transactions. In some other cases, that is a severe problem. And so we need to understand. But we need to plan for failures. They happen, right? How many of you remember of an outage? Oh, they never happen, right? This is perfect. We go to the cloud because in the cloud, they solve all the problems related to hardware, right? Hardware now doesn't fail. Yeah, they do, and often. Latency is a fact of life. I was actually talking to a couple of colleagues trying to look at our architectures, and we were doing imaging processing and viewers and everything, and putting, for example, an MR actually produces about 3,000 images per second that we need to receive the images, actually generate the volume, and then put the volume rendered for the doctor to see. So, yes, latency is critical, I would say. But then we said, how do we do this in the cloud? You can't do this in the cloud because of latency. Latency is a fact of life. It's not a limiting fact of life. It's just a fact of life. What it means is you need to think things differently. One of the things is, why was MapReduce introduced. Why do you do big data projects? Why do you use the MapReduce pattern? Ideas. One at a time. The reason is because we learn that in order to eat an elephant, how do you eat an elephant? Piece by piece. So what we need to do is, how do you want to tackle some of the latency issues? Is you need to put a lot of caching, but you also need to think about new ways of doing this. In an imaging world, what that means is you need to take the image, slice in different bits, throw it to a lot of different compute nodes that are working. They, each of them in a MapReduce pattern, each of them does a processing, then we join them together. Now, because what we're sending is much smaller, the latency impacts is much lower on the process. But until we actually understand that that's a fact of life, until we actually stop trying to do the exact same thing, the exact same paradigms that we used before, until we stop doing that, we will fail. And that's also a fact of life. Another part is consistent availability and partition tolerance, CAP theorem. What does the CAP theorem tells us? You can have the three, right? That's what the theorem says. You can have consistency, availability, and partition tolerance, right? No. Choose two, you won't have three. So you either have consistency and availability, or you have availability and partition tolerance. You can have the three. You need to choose. Your design needs to be able to support the, for example, that if we want to target availability and partitioning, we understand that the consistency, what we are going to be using, is eventually consistency. There won't be consistent acid transactions. It's acid two. It's compensating transactions. We need to understand we can't have it all. Unfortunately, we would love to, but we can't have it all. If we don't think this way when we are planning and designing our architectures, we will eventually hit the roadblock. We will eventually have some issues. Upgrade without downtime requires concurrent services. That's also a critical one. So we go in, we put two cloud services, two instances of a cloud service. We define actually the fault domains, upgrade domains, and all of those stuff. And we go and we do an update, a rolling update. Amazing. I have zero downtime. For that to work, what do I need to make sure? That I didn't have session affinity, for example. Because if I did, goodbye session, goodbye work. So this needs to be something you think about. Also, you can't really know what you don't measure. Telemetry. How many of you use telemetry versus logging? How many of you use logging? How many of you have gigs and gigs of logging and actually look at them? How many actually like doing that? It's like a scavenge hunt. It's like the thing broke. Okay, let me look at the logs. How many of you like Formula One? I love Formula One, by the way. I love Formula One. How does the Formula One cars work? So they do logs, right? And when the car stops, they download the logs and analyze it. Roughly that's it, right? Nope. Real-time telemetry information. Instead of us trying to ask the car what the car is doing, the car is saying to us what it is doing. So we can actually understand what's happening. We can actually act. Telemetry is precisely that. Our solutions, if you want to be to know exactly what your solution is doing, why is your solution behaving the way it is, you need to put telemetry, real-time telemetry. A great example in Azure, you can have, for example, put that into storage and then use a little bit of Solar in order to index it. Another way that I've used in the past is Event Hubs. It's actually amazing. You put that all in Event Hubs, then you have a couple of runbooks, for example. Runbooks that actually is, if this incident goes down, you recover, and this is the automation to recover. And then you basically leverage Event Hubs and Azure Streaming. How many of you know Azure Streaming Analytics? So Streaming Analytics, and we do a little bit of complex event processing on top of our events. And basically we say, hey, if there is a pattern where I'm seeing that the performance of a certain service is degrading, and it's actually responding, for example, hitting the storage account, normally it will take 5 milliseconds or whatever. If in average, over a 5 million period of more, it's taking more than 5 seconds, what I want to do is I want to actually fail over to a secondary location. If I use telemetry, and if my application is telling me all those information, I can do that. That's how I automate my system. And now what I just did is I just made my operation of my system a lot cheaper. Because now I don't need to have someone just looking at the glass and seeing things pass. Those brainless decisions, we can automate them. Why? Because we have the right telemetry. Telemetry is key. You can't do anything if you're not measuring. So another thing is, nothing is like production. So one of the critical parts is, and I had this several times, where we were, and yes, the emulators are amazing. They serve a lot of purposes. There is no such thing as not testing inside actual Azure deployment. If you don't do that, you will have surprises and some nasty ones in the process. So you should always test that. You have an idea, you have an architecture, you implement a quick POC, a skeleton of your application, put it in the Azure deployment, and see how things work. Every now and then, you'll discover that there are some things which are actually a bad idea. Because for some reason, architecting for costs in the cloud is very important also. How many of you normally test your architectures against the costs of those architectures? Anyone? I would recommend that. There are some architecture decisions that you go either go with one service or another service that you probably need to understand if it's a good idea. Telemetry is one of them. So I had a colleague that went and said, oh, this telemetry thing is amazing. So I'm going to per second every single service, and we have hundreds of them because we use microservices. Every single service is going to send all kinds of telemetry information, lifecycle, execution, business, security, all kinds of different ones. Every service, every second. I said, oh, that's amazing. Let me just do a quick calculation. So 150-something services times how many events, so like 5 events per second times the number of customers and instances times this value that is what I pay for the Azure Hubs and the streaming analytics. And it's like, that's a brilliant idea, but that costs about $2 million a year. So maybe it's a good idea, but maybe we shouldn't implement it that way. Maybe aggregate it. Information over like something like 10 seconds is good enough. And then if you want, configuration is also a critical one. You can actually turn more detail on the service that you want to track. So be careful. There is perfect architectures, and there is the ones that we can actually support in the money-wise. So basically, to design something, we need to support for availability. So we need to make sure our solution is available. What's the strategy? How many of you know Udi Dhawan? So if you heard Udi, you will remember. What's the solution for reliability, availability, and scalability? What do you need to put in order to solve this tree? Reliability, availability, scalability. How do you solve that issue? Queuing. It's reliable. It actually enables you to be more available. Why? Because based on the number, you can actually get up and down the number of instances. But if one instance goes down, it still is recovers. So you provide the availability, and it's scalable because now the work is not associated with a single node. It actually can be distributed. So you need to have that in consideration. Scalability data is also critically important when you design that you have data in mind. How am I going to structure my data? How many of you use NoSQL approaches? Column databases, time series databases. There's a whole bunch of options that we have there. How many of you use SQL? So when we design the architecture, what we are going to need to understand is that sometimes we need to denormalize in order to achieve more availability. So, for example, Twitter approach. How many of you know the Twitter architecture? So Twitter approach is when we tweet, it goes into a table that immediately gets a bunch of processes that pick that table and starts sending, duplicating the same information into several different tables in a NoSQL storage. Why? In order to have availability and to have speed, they prefer to actually, NoSQL is actually cheap. So storage is cheap. I can make it more redundant. Yes, there is potentially consistency issues, but I chose availability and partition tolerance from the CAP theorem. That's what they chose. So what that means is when we think about an architecture and we say, hey, I'm going to put all of this services distributed, I'm going to put 15 different instances of this service, good. And then I'm going to connect to a SQL database, which is actually not partitioned. What will happen? Any ideas? You're very quiet. What will happen? Will that work well, or did I potentially create a bottleneck? I created a bottleneck. I need to understand what I'm creating. My architecture, if I really can't do any partitioning, then I need to get my architecture to play it that way. If not, it's not going to work. Agility. Our architecture need to be agile. One of the strategies for doing this is microservices. Agility to go and put something in the flow of the work. Agility to integrate something new right from the start. This is where event-driven architectures came into action. How many of you have been doing event-driven architectures? Let's try it with a different approach. CQRS, Common Query Responsibility Segregation. So that is a strategy that we can leverage because we are basically segregating the responsibilities. We have an event bus in the middle where we send all the actions, all the commands that we want to execute, and then we can pick it up. So if we want to add something more to the process, the only thing we need to do is create that service, put it listening into that same event bus, and it's done. It's integrated. It's not rocket science. It's simple. But for that, you need to have that in mind. Sustainability, also insights, telemetry, and failure. Failures happen. You need to test the failure. So a lot of you should know Netflix Chaos Monkey, right? It's a great idea. It's a great idea. Having a random, an agent that randomly goes and breaks stuff. That's basically what I do for a living. So I call myself a human chaos monkey because that's pretty much what I do every day. It's like, oh, this solution is working very well. And my first question is how many different ways I can break the damn thing. That's what we now have DevOps. DevOps, a DevOps engineer, that's his role. Looking at the architecture, understand potential bottlenecks, breaking points, and try to become a human chaos monkey in the architecture. Then to analyze how to recover, then automate the recovering. And from there on, we have an automated system. That's the role of a DevOps engineer. So that's what we do. So with this in mind, how do we solve this? Microservices patterns. How many of you have been using microservices or know what microservices is? Okay, cool. So what's a microservice? You ask for it. What's a microservice? It's a service that is really, really small. That's why we call it micro. No? So microservices, CQRS, common querying, responsibility segregation, and event sourcing. So let's see. Common query responsibility segregation, what basically says is I'm going to split the two models, the query part and the command part. They will happen in two different ways. They will be segregated. And so I can then, with an architecture like this, I can actually optimize it for read. I can optimize for write. And I can, based on the inflow of information, I can automate this optimization. It's pretty cool. So what happens is, for example, the UI goes and sends a command, like, for example, hey, insert some image. So it sends a command. That command goes to an event bus. That event bus is, there is a small little service here that is listening to that event bus. And when a certain type of event comes, and you only know that, it's a very focused kind of service, only knows one type. It's called a command handler. So he's going to look at that and say, hey, this command type came in. That's for me. He picks it up, opens, does the command, and sends something back to the queue. And if someone wants to do something else, the best option is to actually have that always queue-oriented. So command sends events, event generates commands, commands are handled by command handlers, generate events, and over again. And that's on the command part. On the query part, queries are all about when, for example, I'm going and see, let me see the list of photos that I have. What does normally happen when we have this? So we go, we open a command, we go into our SQL database or to our NoSQL store, and we list what is there, right? That's what we do. Do we really need to do that? What if we actually use a little bit of caching in order to speed up the process? And so the command, when the insert command is finished, we just send the insert completed. And then, for example, the query model can pick it up, pick that command up, and actually update the cache and actually refresh the cache and say, you now have a new image there. You don't need to open the database anymore. What this permits is that now when I query, it's very quick. My reply is already pre-made. Yes, I might actually have some time difference that between inserting and seeing it, but I can't even control it. If I want more, I just put more instances processing that completed image completed kind of command. And then it just makes it quick. But what I just did was created a system which is highly available, which is highly reliable, because it recovers, it's all message driven, and it's highly scalable in every single point. That's the concept of CQRS. The other part is the event sourcing. How many of you in the applications you have, how many of you are in industries that are actually regulated and audited? One, I am. It's not audited. It's beyond audited already. So even if we sneeze, I'm pretty sure we need to log that thing. So one of the parts in the architectures is sometimes there is a break in the application. There is some data that got messed up. So sometimes actually someone comes and says, why is this like it is today? What screwed up my data? What was the action that screwed up my data? So event sourcing is basically a pattern where, remember all the messages that came into this event bus? Event sourcing, what it says is you should store all those messages in the exact same order in somewhere. So we basically go in, we have the command handlers, they make the reservation, and it basically we are storing all the events. In case of CQRS, we're storing only all of the commands. Why? Because if something happened, we can, because we have all the events that led to something, we can immediately go and say, no worries, you want to understand why we are in this stage? I can go through every step of the way. How? I basically create a new deployment, take all my events that I stored in my event store, I start putting them in the right order into the new bus, and I can go and debug every single step of the way, and it will go into the exact same state. So that's the power that we can have if we use this type of architecture patterns. And those patterns are critical for the cloud, because if you're doing a software as a service solution, customers will ask when there is a failure, they will ask, why the hell did that happen? And they will say, they didn't do anything wrong. How many of you actually have the customer say, no, 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 sorry, it was my fault. Like, stupid system. I did everything well. The system's stupid. You did something wrong. I'm awesome. So at least that's the type of customers I deal with. They are perfect. We love customers. We're recording, right? So microservices. So the best definition I found was from Martin Fowler. Microservices are an architecture style, an approach that basically creates those elements that we are seeing here. These are microservices. Single-purpose services, small in its own process, that are able to go communicate in a very lightweight mechanism, normally HTTP, not mandated, but normally over HTTP. They are built around business capabilities. It's a different paradigm because we actually look at this as a vertical slice of business capability, end to end, because then it actually is going to help us when we deploy. And they are independently deployable. That's what the microservices is. So the characteristics is componentization, its organization around business capabilities. So instead of us being working around, for example, security, identity, and so on, is more about capabilities like a microservice for order registration. That doesn't mean we start with this level and then we don't break it up. That's actually, how many of you heard the term monolith? So a monolith and a monolithic applications are not the same thing. Because when microservices came, someone actually said that heard the part of the monoliths. We can create monoliths. And what they heard was, oh, okay, so I can take a monolithic application, put it into a Docker container, put it into the deployment, and cha-na, I'm now using the microservices pattern. I have an answer for them, but I'm not going to say because we're recording. That's not how you do microservices. That's not what the monolith is. A monolith is you shouldn't start in a microservices pattern. We shouldn't start breaking things so small that then turns unmanageable. Monoliths is when we're going and we look at an application and say, I need a user registration, I need an image uploader, I need a listing of customers, for example. These are actual business capabilities, right? These are monoliths that I should create. So I create one, I create the skeleton of this, I mock it up, and then from then I start to break it down in smaller pieces. But I should start with the monolith first and then make it small. If I do the other way around, what you'll see is by the end of what you're doing, you'll end with your application with thousands and thousands of services, which is very helpful when you're trying to manage the damn thing. It's like, oh, there was a failure. In which of the thousand services would that be? Not even telemetry is going to save you. So be careful. They are designed for failure. They are independent, designed for failure. Decentralized data management. Every single microservice should have its own data store. That's what the pattern says. So when we go and we say, I have a microservice, this microservice is actually connecting into MySQL store, which is the exact same store as the other microservice is doing. Are you following the microservices characteristics? No. Because the microservice is all about availability. And if you're creating one centralized system where everything is going, you just destroyed the availability portion of your solution. So embrace redundancy, embrace that fact. So monolith versus microservices. A monolith is basically when I join multiple microservices in the same container. So, for example, Docker containers, I take a Docker container instead of me putting just a single purpose microservices in there, I actually join multiple different microservices. This was the registration. For the registration, I have several steps. I created several microservices, but I actually wrapped it up around the same container. So this is a monolith. A microservice is when I actually containerize each of the services independently. So if we use Docker or CoreOS or whatever for containerization, even Cloud Foundry, what we can do is if we really want to use a microservices pattern, each service will be independent, will be self-contained. Him and only him. What does that mean? Why would we do something like that? Any ideas? Because of the design for failure. If there are multiple things inside that container, when one breaks, and I need to refresh the container, what happens to all the other? they all fail because I need to restart it. If they are independent, I can restart any single one of them at any time without breaking anything. So that's, if we go for the cloud, if we really want to have high available solutions, then these are the best practices that I would recommend to you. So now, questions. Are there personal attacks now already or not yet? Damn it. So lessons learned. This is all pretty and nice. All architecture patterns. Does this work in the real life? What's your opinion? There are a lot of patterns out there. What's the thing that you need to be to have always in mind with a pattern? Is if you use the pattern on the wrong problem statement, what does it make? A mess, an anti-pattern. It actually makes it worse than in the first place. So this has a problem statement. So let's get one. So this was a project I did a couple of years ago. And basically there was an idea that you all have devices, mobile devices. This does a lot of over-the-air updates, right? Windows Phone, you probably have Windows Phone. How many of you have Windows phones? Not a lot. I love Windows phones, but it's not acceptable in my company. That's why I have this. So one of the things, there was a solution. The solution was a very typical solution. I have a set of APIs. This set of APIs have a database which have the firmwares. And I could put rules on that. Typical. It was a typical N-tier approach. So I have the UI tier. I have my application services tier. Then I have some caching. Then I have my blob store. And I have also my relational database store. Typical thing. It was in Azure. Everything was going well. Apart from the fact that the company was paying about $2 million a year in order to support something which was updating about 500,000 devices, everything was good. Life was good. So suddenly there was a question that the $2 million might be a little bit too much. Not for Microsoft. They loved that part. Absolutely. But the customer apparently was having struggles because they actually wanted to continue to grow the number of devices they have. So we implemented a CQRS pattern. So we created a service API. That service API have a service client, which was a very dummy thing. So he basically receives a post, for example, post firmware. And it basically what it did is transform that post into a message, which was a insert firmware message, and placed it into the event bus. Single purpose microservice. Didn't do anything else. It was very, very dumb. Simple. Then command handler, which would go, and let's just go to this version here. So this would come, a post will go, generate the message. That message would then be picked up by the command handler, so insert firmware command handler. What we'll do is actually drop the file that was with the firmware into the storage, update whatever you have to update, and put the set of events saying, I did the insert firmware, and I'm done. I don't even want to care. I'm going to continue to do my work. And from that, there was some event handlers that would continue to pick it up. This was our first approach. And in that case, we have a big one service, one command handler that did validate APK, validate the MD5 hash, and validate the group, which was, so we did everything itself. Then we actually start to segregate because we thought we could make it faster. So, and this was when a command actually came. Then when a query, what would happen on the background is as soon as the insert firmware command was completed, this projection or denormalizer, which is a concept of CQRS, will pick it up immediately. Oh, there's a new firmware. I'm starting to go and work. It will pick it up. It will actually go. We actually have this data access layer. We simplified it. We took it off, and we just placed into JSON files. So all the replies from the APIs were JSON files. And so what we have is we have a list of all the firmwares for each version of the devices already in JSON. And when a new system came in, a new firmware, we would basically replace all the replies for the several versions, saying, this is the new version. This is what you should get if you are in version 1, 2, 3, or 4. Doesn't matter. Right? So everything was pre-done. So when the device actually made the request saying, hey, give me the, are there updates for me? Because it actually sends in the header what version he was on, immediately the only thing that this query service needed to do was to redirect him to the right storage file, which had the reply, the JSON file. So didn't think, didn't do anything. The only thing it did is, based on the header, generated the file name and sent a URL for the file name. It was one of the dumbest services I've ever done. So what do you think happened after doing this? What do you think happened in terms of scalability of the system? So we were supporting 500,000 devices for $2 million a year in Azure spend. So we needed a lot of machines in order to do that. What do you think was the end result when we did this? Because it better give some benefits, because if not, it was just fun. And even though things are fun, the customer normally wants to get something in return. It's a weird thing. Now you can't have fun. So what do you think happened? Did it get faster? Cheaper? Did it get faster? Did we need more or less machines? So what happened is, for the same 500,000, we were able to reduce this cost for about 200,000 a year instead of the 2 million. Because we actually needed, for 500,000 devices, we needed six worker roles in total. Actually, 2 web roles and 4 worker roles. That was it, storage and everything. And we actually were able to understand that the scalability target would actually grow to 1 million devices with the same component, because actually 2 of the machines were there just for failover and to have high availability. So actually, when you do these things, sometimes it's a different way. It's outside of the box thinking, but it actually gets you benefits. Another thing was actually the complexity of the code was much easier. Now when I debugged something, it was a very small piece of code, something like between 10 and 20 lines of code for a single command handler. So if I saw some bug in a command handler, I didn't have to go through like a book in order to try to understand what that developer was doing. It was simple. It was very small. Very focused. That's one of the benefits of this. So to finalize, lessons learned, instrumentation was key. So we only were able to optimize that when we actually first on the old system, we placed telemetry. We understand how the customers were using, what was happening, and from there on, we were able to optimize the solution. We knew exactly what times of the day we would need to optimize for commands and what time of the day we should optimize for queries. So it was at that level that we ended up. Also, watch for the trends over time. Do not watch for the last hour or 2 hours. It doesn't tell you anything. If there is a leak, you only see over a day or so. Because if not, it's not visible. And so optimize for scale. That's a very important part. You need to always understand, optimize the reads, learn to live with stale data. If you don't know how to live with stale data, you always are going to do a solution that is below what you could have achieved. And yes, customers say, I want the data now available. The question is, what's the now means? Real time means a lot of different things for a lot of different people. Understand that requirement and your architectures will be much better. Thank you very much.